Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And we have come to the end of our week-long series on climate change or climate collapse or climate emergency, as we heard different people preferred, different people's preferred language this week. We did the series as part of the joint initiative put forth by our colleagues over at the Columbia Journalism Review, The Guardian, and The Nation that wound up involving 300-plus news organizations to kind of flood the world with stories about the climate in this week leading up to the UN Climate Summit, which is next week here in New York. We also invited you all to join us in the Brian Lehrer Show Plastic Challenge, in which we challenged ourselves to notice how much plastic we come in touch with and see how low we could go this week with single-use plastic, since plastic production is an increasing contributor to greenhouse gas emissions as well as ground level pollution. Now, you didn't have to be perfect. We never asked for that. The exercise was not meant to shame anyone, and we didn't want to claim purity or virtue over anyone else. We just invited you to reduce your use of single-use plastic to the extent that you could and wanted to, and we invited you to take a picture of something during the week that shows a success or a struggle in your plastic challenge effort and post it to Instagram or Twitter using the hashtag Plastic Challenge. Dozens of you participated and tagged us in your Instagram photos and shared some of your struggles, your successes, and your tips for eliminating one-time use plastics. And there were many more people who also called to let us know you weren't on social media, so you emailed us your photos. Thanks to you, too, for participating in this week's Plastic Challenge. On the struggle side, we had a lot of people noticing that their snacks come in single-use plastic packaging. Clean Montclair on Instagram shared pictures of his favorite snacks, including a turmeric tea bag and kiwi fruit, avocado, and cheese. They all come packaged with single-use plastic, all that natural stuff. On Twitter, at KJ noticed that their dental items are all single-use. Also on Twitter, BikeLoveNY asked why their dietary supplements bottle comes wrapped in a non-recyclable single-use plastic. You know how you have to take that little bit of plastic off a lot of bottles before you can get to the lid? On the success side, there were many people who reused your supposedly one-use plastics. We had OBU8 on Instagram, who painted the plastic lid from their cup of coffee and turned it into a piece of art that could be hung up. Seafalk on Instagram shared that they asked for paper only when buying deli meats and cheeses. The stores where Seafalk on Instagram shops have been glad to wrap their deli meats in paper rather than plastic, we are told. Jorekta Kogan, probably mispronounced that name, on Instagram shared that she wraps her children's snacks in a fabric bandana rather than a Ziploc bag. And now we'd like to hear from you about your experiences in the past week. If you did the plastic challenge, how was this for you? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. As we're opening the phones for you now on single-use plastic, especially if you took part in our project this week, but really even if you didn't, what do you find easy and what do you find hard about cutting down on single-use plastics? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And back with us to take your calls is Judith Ink, who was also here last Friday to help us kick off the Plastic Challenge. She's founder of the group Beyond Plastics and a former EPA administrator for Region 2. That means she was in charge of the federal EPA for New York and New Jersey, as well as Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands and 8 Native American nations. And she is currently a visiting professor at Bennington College in Vermont. Judith, thanks so much for coming back on and doing this one more time with us. We really appreciate all your help.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for the putting the spotlight on this issue, Brian.
So I'm going to start with a story of an easier and a harder thing for me this week.
Mm-hmm.
Easy was to carry around a cloth bag and refuse plastic bags at store cash registers. Harder was realizing that some things I want to buy, like these delicious long cucumbers at Trader Joe's, come individually wrapped. And they don't sell them loose. Is that an increasing trend?
Yes. And it's pretty nutty because it, you know, the cucumber is probably capable of making its way through commerce without being wrapped in plastic, like bananas and avocados and so many other things. What's interesting, though, is the many shoppers at Trader Joe's just have had it with all of the over packaging and plastic packaging. And they've sent many emails and phone calls to Trader Joe's. And very recently, Trader Joe's said they will substantially change and reduce their use of plastic packaging. I am waiting to see that. But they have made that public pledge. And so that is encouraging. And it's also a great example of people voicing their concerns directly to their stores and getting results. And I hear a lot from people about supermarkets. You know, you're careful with bags and refillable water bottles, and a stroll through any supermarket aisle is a real problem. So in response to that, we have put a model letter up on our website, beyondplastics.org, that you can tailor any way you want. But it's a letter to managers of supermarkets asking them to reduce the sale of products that are overpackaged in plastic. And so folks should go check that out and maybe even hand deliver it the next time they're at Trader Joe's or whatever shop they go to.
Good one, and good idea to make it easy for people by setting up a template, and then they can just use that and send it in, or as you just suggested, hand it in.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of our listeners wrote that they're not willing yet to simply boycott any produce that's individually wrapped, but their solution to that, or their compromise, is to set a quota for themselves. So just a few per week of produce that's wrapped that way, if it's really a part of their diet. And so that's another way, but yours is really good because it attacks it systemically. Another one for me, easy was to not use the totally unnecessary plastic lid and plastic straw that you would get at, many kinds of restaurants, fast food, and step up from fast food. Like I went to Chipotle in my case. Why use that lid and straw when you can just do what you do at home and drink right out of the cup? But harder was that I got a cup of soup at, I'll say the name of the place, it was Pret a Manger. And my first thought was that this is okay, because I was looking to avoid plastic. And I thought this is okay because it looked like a paper-based cup. And it was. But then when I got to my seat, I realized that the lid on the soup was plastic. Plus, I needed one of their disposable plastic spoons. Aha! And now I don't have a solution for the lid, but I remembered that we give out sometimes these WNYC sporks. You know, a reusable plastic item with a spoon on one end and a fork on the other. And I know people also get these small packs of metal or bamboo cutlery that they carry around. I think I saw you with one last week. But the issue was, what do I do about the lid?
And you were dining in the restaurant?
I was.
Yeah, so that's easier than if it was to go. I think you my experience is you've got to look deep into the eyes of the server because they're used to doing it all day long. It's not an easy job. You look deep in their eyes and you say, "No lid, please." And you can, I know you can carry it from the counter to the table without spilling.
Right. Of course, in this case, in that chain, these soup containers with lids are already out on the shelves, and you help yourself to one.
Okay. So then I think it's a conversation with the manager and saying, can you have some without lids, and explaining why. And they'll probably recognize your voice and cooperate.
Right. Now, you showed me your portable cutlery last week.
Yes.
Is there a kind you like?
I got mine from my local NPR station, WAMC. It was a giveaway, and it's bamboo, fork, spoon, knife, and a little carrying case. I carry it in my purse everywhere I go because I particularly want to avoid those plastic utensils, which are a major litter source. But there are many, many, many different brands that are out there. The other thing people can do is simply take a spoon or a spoon and a fork and put it in some kind of protective wrapping and carry it in their purse. You don't have to, or backpack. You don't have to buy anything special.
There you go. And we learned, and I'll just reinforce this so people don't pollute the recycling stream with it. We learned on yesterday's show from our guest from the Lower East Side Ecology Center that those plastic forks and spoons and knives that you get in a restaurant or you get with takeout are not recyclable, even though right. they're hard. They don't want you right. to put those in with the other hard plastic recyclables because they're not actually recyclable, and they'll pollute the stream, make it harder to sort, and some of your legitimate recyclables may not go through. You agree with that, right?
Totally agree. You should only try to recycle anything that's marked number one, number two, or number five. And there's a bill pending in the New York City Council that would only allow you to get plastic straws upon request. And there is a similar bill, only plastic utensils upon request, because so many people have had the experience of you get takeout, you've got utensils at home, and even if you ask them not to put single-use utensils in the bag, you know, 8 times out of 10, it arrives with, you know, so many napkins and an army can feed off of the condiments and other mm-hmm. things they put into the bag. So I actually think this would save businesses money and be good for the planet if the city council passed these two bills, plastic straws only upon request and plastic utensils for takeout only upon request.
Natasha in Claremont, you're on WNYC. Hi, Natasha.
Hi there. I have found it goes a little beyond single use, but soap in all forms. I've now recently switched from using liquid laundry detergent in plastic bottles back to the old-fashioned powder in cardboard boxes. Also, a bar of soap, not liquid hand soap. Right. My bigger dilemma is dish soap. Not quite sure about that one yet, but.
Yeah, those are really good recommendations. And for your dishes, I am only aware of liquid soap, but if you were to occasionally shop at a food co-op or an environmentally oriented store, sometimes you can bring your old bottle and have it refilled. Mm. I realize a lot of people are not going to do that. But that is an option for dish soap.
But wait, how did they wash the dishes 100 years ago before there were plastic bottles? I have no idea.
I don't know.
All right.
A lot of hot water.
Somebody call up and tell us how your grandparents washed their dishes. But another thing in the same bucket of, the same category that Natasha was talking about, one of my colleagues here at WNYC, who's really into this, says she uses bar shampoo.
Right.
Because, of course, shampoo comes in plastic bottles, and she says she uses bar shampoo specifically to avoid yet another piece of plastic.
Yeah, that's a great development. Shampoo bars that just come in a little recyclable cardboard box. And there are some products that will be both shampoo bars and soap bars. What I'm concerned about is these common sense consumer choices are often more expensive and you can only purchase them online. And I think retail stores that are losing lots of business to online shopping, if they were smart, they would offer things like shampoo bars and bamboo toothbrushes and things like that right in their own store. I mean, stores like, I don't want to name too many names, but Whole Foods has a little section, but it's kind of a boutique-y section. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they have the shampoo bars, but If I was a supermarket executive, which is something I never aspire to, I would look at all of these really innovative, environmentally sound products and get them, mainstream them, get them right in, on supermarket shelves so people don't have to spend extra time and extra money looking around.
You mentioned toothbrushes. We got that question from one of our listeners on social. What do I do about toothbrushes? You're supposed to use them for a few months and throw them out.
Yeah, that is true. You can. There are a couple options. One is food co-ops and health food stores, and online you can get bamboo toothbrushes, so you're not throwing out a petrochemical product. There are also online you can get where you take the brush part of the toothbrush off, and you just put it on and off the handle, so you're not throwing the handle out every time. We don't want dentists mad at us by saying just keep using your toothbrush
forever. No,
but I'm intrigued by the taking the head of the brush off and just throwing out the brush part.
We will continue in a minute on this, including with a call from a listener calling us Brooklyn from Brooklyn, who's, I think, frustrated with some of the options. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we are debriefing our Brian Lehrer Show Plastic Challenge, now that the week-long challenge has ended, with Judith Enck, founder of Beyond Plastics and a former EPA administrator for Region 2, which includes New York, New Jersey, 8 Native American nations, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. And she is currently a visiting professor at Bennington College in Vermont, where she's engaging students on the Beyond Plastics work and some other things. Before we take another call, I wonder, Judith, if you could give us your take on plastics and climate change, because I used to think of plastic pollution as mostly a ground-level problem, including it pollutes waterways and it kills wildlife and other hazards, but I've been reading recently how it's a growing contributor to global warming, too. Do you have a handle on how and how much?
Yes, I do, unfortunately. And so it's, really appropriate that we're talking today, the day of the impressive student climate strike. A lot of carbon emissions are pumped into the atmosphere when you make plastic. It is a petrochemical product, mostly made from fracked gas now. So that's a switch. It used to be made from coal. I'm sorry, it used to be made from oil and chemicals. Now it's made from chemicals and ethane, a byproduct of fracking. So fracking emits methane into the environment itself, and then making the ethane into ethylene, which is now the building block for single-use plastic packaging, emits massive amounts of carbon into the environment, along with other contaminants like benzene. So you've got the front end, you've got the extraction and production, and then on the waste end, if any of the plastic is burned at garbage incinerators, for instance, a large amount of New York City's trash is trucked over to the Ironbound neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey, where it's burned at a massive Covanta garbage incinerator. When you burn that plastic, you will also get significant emissions. So I tell my students, we cannot solve the climate change problem without addressing plastic production and plastic pollution. Projections are that by 2030, if the generation of plastic stays on track the way the petrochemical industry is planning for, the carbon emissions just from making plastic will be the equivalent of emissions released by about 295 new 500 megawatt coal-fired plants. So as the world tries to step back from coal plants and electrical generation from fossil fuels, it's not a coincidence that the fossil fuel industry and the plastic production industry is working together to find new markets for fossil fuels, and that would be for single-use plastic production.
Mm. A lesson from one of our colleagues who said he had to work up the courage to ask for his lunch panini, in paper, not plastic. He says the deli guy looked at him like he was dumb and said, yeah, it's a panini. We were going to give it to you in paper anyway. And he says it was embarrassing, but at least now he knows that asking is easy. Brooklyn in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Is that me?
That's you.
Oh, hi. Hi, thanks for taking my call. Okay, I'm going to, I wanted to participate to the challenge last week to take pictures of my apartment building's garbage collection area. Mm-hmm. And then I decided that, you know, out of respect to my neighborhood and my neighbors, I decided not to do that. Because here's the problem. I'm a perennial gentrifier. I lived in Park Slope. I lived in Bismuth Park. And now I live in deep Brooklyn, okay, where it has not been gentrified yet. And I am a well-disciplined recycling person. However, now I feel like, in this neighborhood, I feel like a fool. Because I recycle, I have three different sets of bags in my kitchen. However, once they go down to the building's garbage area, they are all mixed up. And listen, these communities, these neighborhoods are the larger populations of Brooklyn. And it's people are not informed, educated, and the recycling is not enforced here. Mm-hmm. And in the absence of any reach out to these neighborhoods, I feel like we're playing in a sandbox, educating each other on and on. Whereas,
well, when you say these neighborhoods, are you talking about working class neighborhoods and that meticulous recycling like you do is kind of an elite concern?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying, because I cannot even crack in and establish a recycling pattern, because in the collection areas, in apartment buildings where there are 60, 70 units, there is no enforcement. There is no discipline. Mm. It's not being done.
Brooklyn, I'm going to leave it there. And she called in as Brooklyn and Brooklyn from Brooklyn because she didn't want to give a real name and insult her neighbors and be identified. Out of respect for her neighbors, that was that. But Judith, do you see a class issue here? Because that's really what the caller is raising.
You know, I don't. I worked on the original law that required mandatory recycling back in 1988. And what I heard regularly from lawmakers is, well, I'll recycle, but my neighbors won't. You know, I'll do it, but my kids won't. And what needs to happen is you need to make it convenient for people. And I think your caller raised a really good point that you have to constantly educate. There's a big problem with so many people staying at Airbnbs from out of town, and they don't know what the recycling rules are. New York City doesn't have what's called single stream recycling, where you mix all the recyclables all together. So I had a similar frustration in my building in Brooklyn, and I can't tell you how much time I would spend on a Saturday just going down to the recycling area and just resorting. And that was easier if it's not, you know, sorted at all. But I would recommend a few things. One is the caller should talk to the building manager and say there needs to be signs. You can get, there's very good education material from New York City Department of Sanitation. I put signs up in my apartment. I slid the flyers under people's doors. And then, you know, it's really up to the building manager to make sure that there are bins, that it's clearly marked. A lot of times there's not. And then also, I have found New York City to be pretty effective in handing out tickets if you mess up on recycling. I was concerned about this in my relatively small apartment building in Brooklyn. And within a few weeks, and I didn't call in, we got a $450 fine from sanitation.
That'll get your
and
attention.
That got everyone's attention, yeah. And things really, really improved. But I think people in working class neighborhoods and low income neighborhoods are interested in protecting the environment and recycling as compared to more affluent neighborhoods. It's a matter of making it easy for people and making sure everyone knows the rules.
Hey, we have breaking news about this. This just came in during the show. This version is from Inc. magazine, and the headline is, Amazon just bowed to employee pressure and agreed to use 100% clean energy by 2030. And the next line is, Amazon employees plan to walk out as part of today's global climate strike, and it seems to have already gotten results.
That is fantastic news. And I also implore Jeff Bezos and Amazon employees now to pivot to the outrageous amount of plastic packaging that they use shipping their products. We need Amazon and other big shippers to use less plastic when they ship you material and to use their innovative skills and come up with some reusable, returnable packaging. So this is indeed good news that they're shifting to renewables. But for Amazon, there's so much more that needs to be done.
Russell in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Russell.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I told your screener, one of the remarks I had was I work in Midtown Manhattan. I'm in my mid-30s, and when we go out for lunch, I'll often ask for no plastic bag, and I see some of my younger colleagues doing the same. It sounds like this new bill does address stores and companies will have to default to not offering such bags. But what about a bag tax? I know I was visiting Connecticut this summer, and I was delighted when I had to pay 10 cents for a bag at Walmart. And it seems to have done a great job there, even though people are grumbling. And then just the last thing, especially on food delivery services, MealPal, et cetera, the packaging is so outrageous. I wonder if, there's a way of taxing either the materials at the production level or the companies, because, we can all take a very small action, but unless we get to a level of addressing this at a company level, our small additive actions don't add up to a lot.
If
CBS or Dwayne Reed didn't give me a default plastic bag, that would do a lot more of a benefit than, being careful about my plastic toothbrush.
And they're going to keep doing it until policy tells them that they're not allowed. Russell, thank you. Please call us again. Judith, we're almost out of time. Respond to him and state your number one or two policy prescriptions for really dealing with this systemically instead of individually.
Well, New York State will ban all plastic bags in retail effective March. And New York City will also have a 5-cent fee on paper. So that really helps. But on the systemic problems, we really need state legislation that deals particularly with food delivery, the Amazons of the world. We need environmental standards for that packaging so they don't keep over-packaging. I am afraid companies are not going to change on their own, and we need the New York State legislature to deal with it.
One more quick one from a listener. Damien writes on Twitter, the single-use packaging for my daily contact lenses, the challenge that we did, has made me rethink wearing contacts at all. Do you have a solution for daily contact lens wearers?
I do not, but I'm glad he is paying attention to it.
And we leave it there with Judith Enck, founder of the Beyond Plastics Environmental Campaign. Under President Obama, she was the EPA administrator for what they call Region 2, which is New York and New Jersey, Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands and 8 tribal nations. She was previously the Deputy Environment Commissioner for New York State, and she is now a senior fellow at the Center for Advanced Political Action at Bennington College in Vermont, where she is engaging students in conjunction with the Beyond Plastics campaign. Thank you so much for being such a great partner and advisor on this. People really learned a lot from you in these two appearances. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, you may have heard that men are from Mars and women are from Venus, or maybe you've heard that men are like waffles and women are like spaghetti. There's this idea that's been out there a long time that men and women have fundamentally different brains. But joining me now is a neuroscientist who says to all that, baloney. She says that the theories behind those myths come from bad science being used to justify bad stereotypes. Gina Rippon is an honorary professor of cognitive neuroimaging at the Aston Brain Center at Aston University in England, and the author now of Gender and Our Brains, How New Neuroscience Explodes the Myths of the Male and Female Minds. Professor Rippon, so nice to have you here. Welcome to WNYC.
Nice to be here.
So let's just go over some of the things you call myths in the book. One, men are better at certain things like spatial reasoning, and women are better at other things like empathizing. Why not?
Well, I think one of the things we need to look at right from the beginning is what we mean by difference. Men and women are actually more similar than they are different, and I think that's a basic premise that people forget. They assume we're looking at men being from Mars and women being from Venus, and there's no overlap between them. I think the spatial cognition example you gave is a great example. It's long been held that this is one of the most robust sex differences, and that men, on average, are better at these kind of tasks than women, and that's why there are more men scientists, why men get Nobel Prizes, etc. But if you then look at, for example, the kind of experiences that people have, whether or not they've had experience of playing with construction toys as a child, or whether they have hobbies or occupations which are linked to that kind of skill, if you look at a spatial experience score, you find that that accounts for many more differences than the biological sex of individuals.
Spatial experience score, meaning based on the experiences that people have starting as a young child, how much they've been conditioned to use their brains in certain ways.
Yeah, they've had training opportunities. And we also know that spatial cognition can be trained, so that people struggle with those kind of skills.
How do you actually correct for that, being that the division of men and women into these kinds of professional fields, for example, is so pervasive?
Well, you can statistically correct for it by doing exactly what the researchers I've just mentioned did. Take an initial, what looks like a clear-cut sex difference, and say, let's also factor in a video game experience, for example, or playing with Lego. And then you find the sex difference disappears.
Another myth, as you call it, men only use the left side of their brains while women use both.
Yeah, that's based on a myth in itself, because the idea that we have a left brain and a right brain was a very nice metaphor early on to explain different contributions, apparently different contributions of the brain to different skills. But we now know the brain doesn't work that way. But it also then got attached to the idea that this was related to a sex difference. And these kind of metaphors and myths have amazing stickability, which is really what my book is about, saying, let's really look at the science and find out if these are true.
Another one you call a myth is that hormonal differences cause men and women to behave differently and to have different abilities. But people might say, well, shoot someone with testosterone, male or female, and see what happens to them.
Yes, the idea of hormones is really important. And I think part of that is that we forget that hormones really determine that we have two different types of body. You know, there's something prenatally happens to the fetus, and they're born either male if they've been exposed to testosterone, or female if they've not. And then people extrapolated from that to say, well, that also organizes the brain differently. And so hormones get drawn into the whole argument about two types of body equaling two types of brain, and those two types being distinct.
You know, coincidentally, next week we'll have as a guest on the show an evolutionary psychology researcher, Sarah Hill, who has a new book about the impact of birth control hormone treatments, the pill basically, as she sees it, on the brain's chemistry, and that taking the hormones in birth control pills change a lot of things about the individual women who take them, including the kinds of people they're attracted to and other things. So what about that as evidence in the other direction?
Well, I think I'm certainly not dismissing biology at all. Some people say, oh, you think it's all culture, no biology. I think the idea that it's either nature or nurture is another myth, actually, which is past its sell-by date. What we need to look at is how much what external events can change our brains. And that could be taking different sorts of chemicals. And hormones are a key part of who we are and what we look like. And that in itself will interact with the world in a very particular way.
So it's that there are some biological differences, but we can't even isolate what they are because the experiential differences are so vast and haven't been corrected for yet?
That's a great way of putting it. I mean, I think that's exactly the problem. The two are so entangled. But it's really only in the 21st century we started to realize how profound the impact of what happens outside the brain is, as well as the kind of unfolding biological template inside it.
In the book, you refer to young kids as junior gender detectives. What do you mean?
Well, another of the things that we realize in the 21st century is that we've always viewed babies as sort of pretty human babies are pretty helpless and dependent for a long time. So we assume this also was reflected in the kind of skills they had. And we now know that human babies arrive in this world with amazingly finely tuned social antennae. And they're picking up all sorts of social cues from the world around them right from the day they're born. But as they grow, they're looking into that society and seeing what kind of differences are being emphasized. And certainly in most societies, and I think more profoundly in the 21st century, gender is something which is really being emphasized via all sorts of routes. And children are very good at picking that up. And so they decide they're a boy or a girl and what that means.
And not only for themselves, you write that children wind up enforcing gender roles in their peers.
Yes, that's right. Yes, what I call the gender police around the dressing up box in nurseries are quite amazing to watch.
And the way you describe children, quote, learning the rules of their gender flies in the face of the idea that males and females have different brains.
I think it does. I mean, I think one of the things that we need to understand is if we're working backwards from what we see in the world, gender gaps in all sorts of issues, behavior, aggression, for example, we say there must be some kind of biological basis for this because we ignore the fact that these differences have been arrived at by the pressures of all sorts of different external factors as well.
You talk a little bit in the book about transgender people and people who don't identify with either end of the gender binary, and you're right, they feel that something has gone wrong with their biology gender link, so they wish to realign it by changing their biology to be consistent with the gender they identify with. But perhaps we should be challenging the link, unquote. Challenging it how?
Well, I think what we need to break, and that's very much as a brain scientist what I've been looking at, what is the evidence that the biological characteristics of our brain are the primary determinant of our identity, of our temperaments, our personality, etc. And I think the evidence is that they are not. They're part of that link, but not the whole answer. But because we have this very profoundly emphasized gender differences in the 21st century, children will look at this list, or individuals will look at this list of this is what it means to be a boy or a man or a girl or a woman, and think none of the above applies to me. But if you have a belief that your biological characteristics determine your gender, you think, well, there must be something wrong with my biology. What I'm saying is, A, we should challenge that link, and B, actually challenge the idea that there's only two boxes that you can belong to.
Last thing before you go, does the neuroscience that you write about as a scientist give ammunition to politics or corporate policy with respect to gender? I think things are moving in the direction, however too slowly, that everybody should be given the equal opportunity to succeed and advance and study and get hired and promoted and be paid the same things. We know that one's not there yet. But these biases are still there under the surface in many cases.
Yeah.
Is there one sort of killer app argument from neuroscience that people can pull out at the right times when they need to?
Well, I think the study I've just mentioned about this whole idea of spatial cognition, I'm very interested in the underrepresentation of women in science. And people say, well, they've got the wrong sort of brain. And we know from the Google Memo author that there's a still strong belief in that. And if they actually, if people fall into the trap of believing that that's an issue, then they will continue to think along gendered lines. So, you know, I always say let sex not be the first thing you see or the last question you ask.
Gina Rippon, Honorary Professor of Cognitive Neuroimaging at the Aston Brain Center and Aston University in England, and the author now of Gender and Our Brains, How New Neuroscience Explodes the Myths of the Male and Female Minds. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Seen the new movie Hustlers? If so, you might remember that that's the song playing when Jennifer Lopez makes her entrance. The movie centers on what two former strippers, played in the movie by Lopez and Constance Wu, do after the recession hits in 2008. Their solution is pretty entrepreneurial, but also highly illegal. They start drugging men to scam them out of massive amounts of money. But here's the thing. This really happened in New York. And my guest now, New York Magazine contributing editor Jessica Pressler, wrote about it in 2015 in a piece called The Hustlers at Scores. And she's in the studio with me now to talk about that story and why people are captivated by it 4 years later and why a version of it is on the big screen. Jessica, welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So here's the top of your article from 2015. Quote, here's a modern Robin Hood story for you. A few strippers who stole from mostly rich, usually disgusting, in their minds, pathetic men and gave to, well, themselves. So talk about that story you told that came to inspire the film.
So the story was about a group of women who had worked in various capacities at strip clubs in the city, who were arrested in, I believe, 2013 for allegedly drugging men, customers, and swiping their credit cards and stealing, I believe it was $200,000 was the figure that was bandied about.
How'd you find this story? What led you to it?
So I had done a story a few years before about a woman who worked at Scores who had married a customer who turned out to be running a giant Ponzi scheme. It was kind of this reverse Cinderella story.
And maybe we need to say for context for some people that Scores is a strip club?
Scores is a strip club, a very famous strip club, made famous by Howard Stern in the early 2000s. She had told me kind of about how working at a club like this had changed her, in particular her attitude towards men. She saw so many things. She experienced so many kind of uncomfortable situations that she kind of turned off and stopped seeing men as people a little bit. So when I saw the headline a few years later, I was reminded of those conversations, and it seemed to me to be kind of like a natural progression of that attitude.
And listeners, we can take a few phone calls. If anyone has seen the movie, did you know the movie was based on a true story? Who were you rooting for? Or has anybody listening been in the kind of situation in your own life that could have led you to even contemplate such a thing? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine, who wrote the original article that the movie Hustlers is based on, 212-433-9692. Can you bring us back into the politics of the moment when the ringleader, Rosie Keough and Samantha Barbash, are developing their hustle? Is there a political context here?
I think in the movie it's much more on the surface. In real life, I mean, the recession happened in 2008. It directly affected the clubs. The clubs always were directly affected in New York by what was going on with the stock market. If the stock market was booming, then the club was booming. When 2008 happened, it was kind of a double whammy because not only was there not, you know, the enormous amount of money that had been coming in beforehand due to all of the loose regulation and all of that, people didn't want to be seen in strip clubs. Guys on Wall Street would have been, you know, if they worked at Goldman Sachs, would have been killed on Page Six for appearing in a strip club. So they just kind of thoroughly emptied out. And so it did directly impact business.
And I gather that the movie makes the point that this is payback for the crash. even more than your article, here's a bit from one of the trailers.
These Wall Street guys. You see what they did to this country? They stole from everybody. Hardworking people lost everything. And not one of these douchebags went to jail.
The game is rigged, and it does not reward people who play by the rules.
But it's like robbing a bank, except you get the keys. Are you in?
So I'm curious if the women you talked to went there.
It's really interesting. So I think that certainly we can't confuse these women with the people who were sleeping in Zuccotti Park in 2011. They're not Occupy Wall Street. It wasn't, you know, such a direct populist act. But I do think that that is a lesson that people learned in 2008 that is articulated very well in this movie that we all kind of took in from that experience. You know, that even if you weren't paying attention to the kinds of ins and outs of the financial crisis and knowing what a mortgage-backed security was, you were aware that these people had done something bad, our economy was ruined in many ways, and nobody had gone to jail and nobody was responsible. Nobody paid the price, so to speak. So I think that everybody internalized that lesson one way or another, and it kind of became a part of our culture.
Sue in New Rochelle, who just saw the movie. Hi, Sue. You're on WNYC.
Hi. I love your show. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I had watched the previews, obviously, but I hadn't really known how the movie was going to be. And I was a little surprised at how much you really wound up rooting for the strippers. There was this one man that you felt badly for, but generally speaking, you really just kind of were like, yes, please, keep going. And it was peculiar because you did see them doing these terrible things, and yet you still wanted them to win.
Why do you think, in your case, Sue?
I think possibly because I had seen Big Short not that long ago.
The Big Short about the horribleness on Wall Street.
Yes, and also you do know that nobody really paid, for lack of the better word, for that. So watching it, you're just kind of like, oh. Yeah, they kind of deserve this. And they were generally not depicted as being the nicest of people anyway. So you really did just wind up rooting for them to just fleece them.
Jessica, what are you thinking?
Yeah, no, I think it's really interesting. And I think that you're supposed to feel that way. Also in the way that you realize it's a little bit messed up that you feel that way. I think that's kind of the dark humor and the very like subtle kind of amazing thing that Laureen did with this, where you're rooting for them and then you're like, wait, no, this is very bad. And you do have that moment when the character, Doug, as he's called in the movie, comes on screen. You're like, oh, right, this is the moment where you realize that this is actually really
bad.
Terrible.
Yeah. Alyssa in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for calling.
I was just calling to just make a comment on the nature of what you see working in a strip club, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
I worked at a strip club throughout my college years as a cocktail waitress, and I was a witness to really what the worst each gender could do to each other every shift. I saw, you know, the dancers steal from the clients, and the clients just treat the dancers like they were not human.
Does your experience make you want to see this movie or avoid it?
I would definitely love to see this movie, but just saying that I think that the people can get caught up in the cycle of a strip club.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that's a big piece of it, for sure, for the real people. That the way they talk about it now is that they got caught up in a lifestyle and it. And things got out of control a little bit.
Alyssa, thank you so much for your call. We're talking with Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine, who wrote the original article in 2015 that wound up in the movie that just came out this month, Hustlers, with Jennifer Lopez and Cardi B and others. And you were portrayed a little bit in the movie, or a character based on you, by Julia Stiles.
Right. I recommend it. She's fantastic. So anybody who needs to be portrayed in a movie.
This is like a journalist's dream, isn't it? You write a story, you do, you know, a legitimate piece of local journalism. Hollywood likes it, makes a movie of it, and Julia Stiles plays you.
It's pretty dreamy. I know the answer to the question of who would play me in a movie.
That's right.
A fun thing.
And do you get, if you don't mind my asking, do you have input? Did you have input while the film was being made, or you know, did you get bought out for your rights to the story? How does that work?
Yes, I did have input. I was like a consultant on the film. I had many conversations with the producer, Jessica Elbaum, and the director, writer, Laureen Scavaria. As far as input on the character, like I gave input. I don't know that it was always taken, but I couldn't help myself from giving input.
Tara in Metuchen, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tara.
Hi. I'm calling to ask a question. I loved the movie, and I wanted to know if at the end of the movie, when Jennifer Lopez's character, she has a little memento of Constance Wu's character in her wallet. I wanted to know if that was real or if that was creative license, and if, you know, like what their relationship might be like now in real life.
Right, yes, the Destiny and Ramona relationship. So in real life, I think these women became close over the course of these events. It was not as close a friendship, or in hindsight to them, it was not as close a friendship as the Ramona Destiny. If Samantha has a locket with Rosie's picture in it, that is her own secret. I think it was creative license in that particular case.
So in the context of movie history, do you see this as in any kind of tradition? The Washington Post review, for example, very positive, called it a caper flick.
Right. I think it is a very layered, nuanced narrative about the financial crisis and gender politics wrapped up in a caper flick. Yes.
Yeah. And last night, I don't know if you saw this, on the red carpet before the Emmys on E.T., Emilia Clarke from Game of Thrones showed up wearing a very low-cut dress that she said was inspired by J-Lo's character, and she said this.
I think that J-Lo in Hustlers is the greatest introduction of a character I have ever seen. I heckled in the cinema. I'm English. I don't do that.
Right.
But I did. So J-Lo is my inspiration for this evening. I plan on channeling her all night long.
So never mind the other storyline from last night that everyone expected Emilia Clarke to win Best Actress in her category, but Jodie Comer from Killing Eve won it instead. What about Emilia's superlative there? For J-Lo and the character.
I mean, I think J-Lo blew everybody away in that part. She is an amazing actress and always has been, and just absolutely killed it. So I'm not surprised that she's inspiring people.
Eric in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Basically, you know, this is a movie about a crime, and it doesn't matter that the people that you are stealing from are not nice people. It still doesn't justify the crime. If you turned this around and had a group of guys who had lost their jobs or lost their source of income and hustled the wives of rich men for their credit cards and drugged them especially to get those credit cards, everyone would be outraged. Mm-hmm. And it would be a movie about predators instead of about heroines.
Yeah, that's true. This is definitely a movie about the underdog. These women are not...
Because of 10,000 years of human history?
Yeah.
And where the power has lied?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's true, yes. If you flipped it, it would not be a feel-good movie for sure. It would be a different movie. If you flipped Thelma and Louise, it would be a different movie as well, or 9 to 5, or any of those movies where it's basically repressed people acting out against a system of repression. That said, I don't think it presents it as the right thing to do.
Right, though clear, and you've said that a few times already, and clearly it doesn't present it as the right thing to do. Does it kind of argue that the bias we've seen in the criminal justice system against people who are victimized while drunk or on drugs cuts both ways, even against wealthy white men? They may not believe their claims?
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. When I was reporting this story, I mean, there's a line in the movie where the cop says, men don't like to admit to being victimized by women. And that was a real thing that somebody said. It was embarrassing for these guys to come forward. There were according to the police, you know, many more people that they could not get to admit. I mean, I called people who just straight hung up on me. It was embarrassing. Yeah, it's sad what happened.
So this story of yours from New York Magazine from 2015 inspired the movie Hustlers with Jennifer Lopez, Cardi B, Constance Wu, Julia Stiles, and others, now out. What's your next article? We should probably keep an eye on your work.
Oh, thank you. I'm not going to tell you that.
You're not going to tell me?
You have to wait.
Okay. What's your last article?
My last article that I did that was big for is the Anna Delvey con woman story that is now being adapted by Shonda Rhimes.
The fake German heiress.
The fake German heiress.
Oh, that one's going Hollywood too?
Yep.
Unbelievable. Jessica Pressler from New York Magazine on the fast track with good journalism. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.